From the public radio website transom.org in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Jay Allison, and this is Anatomy of a Code Blue, produced by Sam Slavin with Vicki Merrick.
We watch The Price is Right, something we don't even really watch all that often. The people didn't win the thing, and we laughed, and it just ended, and the nurse came in to give him a Tylenol, and when she went to put the Tylenol up, he let out this like a growl sound. His face got scarlet. Scarlet, and then he went white. His head went back, and I screamed to him. I screamed Bob, and he made that growl sound again. His eyes went up, and he just didn't know what was happening. To be honest with you, I didn't know. And then the nurse just like kind of flung across him, so I don't know if she was hitting the code. And there must have been 50 people coming through the door.
Cardiac arrest. The moment a patient's heart stops beating activates a response most hospitals call a code blue. My name is Sam Slavin. I'm a medical student at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. I started recording these interviews because I wanted to know what a code blue meant for everyone involved.
I had a direct view into the room. And I saw like a look of horror on his wife's face and saw the staff emergency button. And I knew right away, so I ran into the room and established non-responsiveness and dropped the bed and started compressions.
Chaos in there, like everybody's like over, because it's like the bed, they're circling around the bed. You can see.
A flurry of activity, chaos, perhaps yelling, clothes being either cut off, stripped off, or removed.
In a full-blown cardiac arrest.
Naked, staring at the ceiling, surrounded by
chaos.
It is that overall chaotic,
and you
organized chaos, I think that's
where you can tell there isn't the right exchange of air.
People know what needs to get done, and it just gets done.
I wanted to hear from the full range of hospital staff.
I'm a senior resident in internal medicine.
I'm a unit coordinator.
Patient care technician.
I'm a priest.
I'm a nurse.
I'm one of the internal medicine interns.
For housekeeping.
I'm the social worker in the emergency department and in the trauma surgical ICU.
I spoke to those who were experiencing it through fresh eyes and the hardened veterans.
I used to be able to keep count. In the last year alone, I have been part of 10 codes.
Maybe 15, 20 is a lot.
I've probably been part of about 50 codes over the past 3 years in a very direct way.
There's some weeks where we might have two or three.
I cannot exactly say. That's more than 100 or so.
I've been here 34 years, probably at least 30 a year, so I probably over 1,000.
There are lights, big flashing red lights on the ceiling of the hallway. And also up above the door frame.
The first alarm alerts the hospital unit. Corey is a nurse and often among the first to respond.
It's this very loud beep that's not like any other beep that you hear in the hospital. And there's a recorded voice that says staff emergency. It just says staff emergency. Staff emergency. And it says it kind of like that. Like we had this one doctor whose voice actually sounded somewhat similar. Every time I would hear his voice, I would always panic a little bit that there was a staff emergency going on somewhere.
Another series of alarms activates the code blue itself. The PA system announces it to the entire hospital.
It just goes beep, and then an announcement comes over the loudspeaker saying, attention, code blue. Code team, please respond.
Sharon is a physical therapist.
Whenever I hear a code blue, I always pause because I am a religious person and it's difficult to know that someone's in that much distress. But also, I tend to say a short prayer for that person. Life is only so long for each one of us.
At the same time, a barrage of pages goes to the members of a specialized code team.
It's 10 at night. You're on call in the intensive care unit.
Heather is a senior resident in internal medicine.
Suddenly, the ominous and eerily melodic tone of the code pager goes off.
Do-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no-no- That's the tone of the Code Blue pager.
People running above you, running below you, are sort of echoing through the stairwell.
And you see all these people running. It's like, it's not just one person that's coming, it's like everybody come in.
I run as everybody run into that place.
The page goes to physicians, nurses, pharmacists, respiratory therapists, and often the chaplain. Here is Father Chris.
They page me specifically, please, Father Chris, come in. This person is dying. My first encounter is to go to the patient, administer the sacrament.
As teams of people hurry to converge on one room, the housekeeping staff prepares for them.
It's my job to clear the way so they can find space to pass.
Marie has been a housekeeper at the hospital for over 30 years.
While they're running, someone's foot might catch, and then that's another emergency.
You know, the first few times you want to run yourself, and that is the fight or flight response, I think.
Patty is a senior nurse supervisor and educator.
My memories are very vivid of people that have run from the room. It has happened on more than one occasion. I took them by the arm and said, we're going to do this together. You know, we're going to do this together.
And you almost have no idea what you'll see when you show up. My first response always is, I always ask people, who is running the code? And I ask again, who is running the code? And if I don't hear anyone say it, my third sentence is, I'm running the code.
Running the code means guiding the team to perform several essential functions, including chest compressions to circulate the blood and electrical shocks to restart the heart.
1, 2, 3, 4.
I'm kind of known at work for being like the guy who does compressions, and I always break a ton of ribs, so I always feel really bad about it afterwards because it's not something that you want to do, but it's necessary. So you got to compress at least 2 inches down, and I'm not shy about it. It's someone who's doesn't have a heartbeat in front of you, and you have to beat for them. And I'm tall enough to be able to do that, and I'm a big guy, so I have enough mass to be able to really make sure that I do what I feel are quality compressions.
When you learn to do CPR, they teach you to think about, you know, one of these songs that's roughly at about 100 beats per minute.
Patrick is an intern in his first year of training.
Something like, you know, Staying Alive or Another One Bites the Dust. There's a bunch of songs that are like 100 beats a minute. And it was almost like this weird moment where all of a sudden I'm doing this and I can hear the song in my head. But I remember thinking of how weird that was.
Chest compressions stop only to analyze if the heart's electrical activity can be reset with a shock from the defibrillator.
So the defibrillator, I would say, is kind of, it's about the size of like one of those old school boom boxes from like the late 90s, you know, early 2000s. You know, you press this button to charge it up, and it kind of, it makes this funny sound like, as it's charging.
It's a time vacuum, you know, seconds feel like an eternity. You're just willing the machine to charge faster. Like, their life is dependent on this shock. Just finish already.
And then when it's ready to fire, it makes this really awful, alarming sound that's kind of like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And so that's when it's charged up and starts making that sound, the person operating the defibrillator is supposed to, you know, say, everyone clear the patient, you know, I'm shocking in 3, 2, 1.
It's just their whole body kind of convulses and contracts, tenses up. You'll see like a lot of their arms and their legs kind of will either move on the bed or lift up a little bit off the bed and then relax back down and kind of just rest back on the bed. I always twinge with pain when I see someone get shocked at that involuntary muscle contraction.
Initially, when I would go to a code, my mind would be totally scrambled, and everything seemed like static.
LCO2 is right over there behind the bell.
Amidst this static, physicians leading the code must find the mental clarity to think about why the cardiac arrest happened in the first place and how to treat the underlying cause.
It was almost like you couldn't hear anything, you couldn't see anything, even though your eyes are open and your ears are open.
There is absolutely a sense of aloneness at first.
Adarsh is a senior resident in internal medicine.
Even with the best CPR and defibrillation taking place, you have to also turn to your medical training and think about, why is this happening and what am I going to do? So there's what I feel is a ridiculous mnemonic called the 5 H's and 5 T's, different conditions that could cause this. Some of them are at direct odds with each other. Hyperkalemia, potassium, hypokalemia, hypothermia, hypovolemia. Well, at the same time, are trying to organize everyone on the team and making sure that someone is getting an IV line in each arm, that the chest compressions are deep enough, the nurse is managing the monitor, someone else managing the code card,
getting the medications ready. To when the
pharmacist gets as you go forward in training, you know what matters more than when you first started. You also learn to ask for help.
What I tell the new trainees is to choose a code whisperer. And what a code whisperer is someone, it could be another resident, it could be a nurse, to stand next to you, right behind you, and simply be there to whisper into your ear things that maybe you're missing.
The nurses are our biggest allies in the respiratory techs in code situations.
Kieran is also an internal medicine resident.
You're not going to pick the wrong medication. The nurse is going to pull the correct medication, hold it up, and say, is it okay if I give this?
I think one of the ways to help break the silence and to ensure that you're not missing anything is to just open up to the crowd and ask them very simply, does anyone have any other suggestions?
People don't think in terms of title or rank or anything like that anymore. If someone throws out a good idea, it's not, you know, or an idea of what might be happening, it's not, oh, like, who are you to throw out this idea? Like, it might just be, oh, you're just a nurse, or oh, you're just an intern, what do you know? But that kind of goes out the window, and someone throws out an idea, and it's, you know, if it's a good idea, you know what, that's a good idea, let's roll with it.
We were in the ICU, and we got this patient who was bleeding and bleeding and bleeding, and within, over the span of maybe like 2 hours, I saw the nurses give the patient around 60, 70 products of blood. Something that seems almost impossible. I mean, just for reference, usually when we give someone a blood transfusion, it have one unit goes over 2 hours.
Hayden was in awe at the nurse's technical skill to deliver so much blood so swiftly.
It was like going to the opera. It was like seeing like a huge orchestra come to life and work in such magical union.
Any, you know, I've seen people who I know don't like each other. And then you come together in a code, and all of a sudden they're working together like nothing ever happened. It's just funny how that kind of all happens. Everyone comes together focused on what's going on at that moment.
The code accomplishes its goal when there is return of spontaneous circulation. This means that the patient's heart is beating again and delivering enough blood to sustain life. The signs of spontaneous circulation include breathing, coughing, or movement. Yet it is most directly felt in the return of a palpable pulse.
Does she have a pulse?
We actually had about 4 people checking for a pulse, one on each femoral and one on each carotid. So the people feeling the carotids are at the head of the bed and they're feeling the pulse on the neck. And the femoral is, you feel it in the groin, kind of near the hips. The person who was standing beside me on one of the femorals got the pulse first and was like, I have one. I have a pulse. And then the person across from me said, you know, no. And then they had agreed. And then you can kind of hear, you know, I have one. I don't have one yet. And then, oh, no, I have one. And you can hear almost a hint of maybe apprehensive excitement that they have a pulse return. And then everyone kind of, as they're all feeling pulses, gain confidence in their, I have a pulse.
We say that we've gotten circulation back, but I think calling that a successful code is a misnomer. In reality, the patient is absolutely not out of the woods. You might get broken ribs. You might get even punctured lungs, and you get air building up under the skin. The patient has a breathing tube in, and it's not like the breathing tubes you get in the operating room where it's a controlled situation, or the IV lines that you get when you're admitted to the hospital. This was all done in an emergency situation. The room is very messy. There's probably blood in places.
Everywhere.
There are times I go in and say, oh, sometimes the nurses need to help me. After a code, I could compare it to if you've seen a tornado and you see everything is smashed and everything is strewn about. That's how I see it. You find some rooms that don't have much on the floor. It makes me think, maybe that person survived.
What
am I thinking? I'm thinking, God, let this person live. Because sometimes you're with that person every day, and you did not see it in the face of that person that he could fall into such a state. He was looking fine, and then all of a sudden you hear, and the person has gone out. While you're working, you're saying, God, heal this person. Heal this person. So that's why when I return the next morning, I always ask if they've heard anything about this person from the ICU.
You know, people don't just immediately wake up after a code blue situation. They're in the ICU and they have a long road ahead of them. And the chances of them surviving the next few hours are not 100%. The next 24 hours also not 100%.
In the major medical dramas on TV, 75% of codes get back a heartbeat, and most of these patients walk out of the hospital. The actual data are more sobering. We get back a heartbeat about 50% of the time, and less than half of these patients live to leave the hospital. About 20% of all patients who have a cardiac arrest survive to be discharged. Of those who do leave, 10% have severe loss of brain function, defined as total dependence on others for activities of daily living, paralysis, or coma.
We can bring people back, and I've seen where people walk out of the hospital in a few weeks, but generally speaking, for that to happen is not a pretty process.
A code blue begins when someone decides to call a code. This means to sound the alarm and bring in the code team. When the team is not able to bring the patient back, someone must decide when it is time to stop trying. A decision referred to with a subtle difference as calling the code, or simply calling it. This decision often falls to the leading physician or a family member.
The family was able to kind of pull together and say, this is the person who should be making the decision.
Margot is a social worker. During a code, she often accompanies the family.
And eventually I walked her to the room, and she stood in the doorway, and I remember her seeing what was happening and just kind of crumpling to the floor and starting to yell that she wouldn't want this to stop, that you've got to stop, that you've got to let her go. And they did.
When the decision falls to the physician, it is more complicated. It is based on how patients have responded during the code so far and their previous state of health. There are no official guidelines on when or how to do this.
Once you actually decide to end the code, I think I always pause and prepare myself to actually stop. So maybe let it go on and just think about how to actually do it, especially if the family is in the room. And it often is very helpful to focus everyone again when you're getting into that late period of a code. So I will say, just to summarize for everyone, this is a 75-year-old female who came in with renal failure. She was found unresponsive and pulseless. CPR was started at this time. We've now gone through 5 rounds of epinephrine. We've given her 3 shocks. Her rhythm is currently asystole. We've given her bicarbonate. We've given her insulin
and then
dextrose.
Simply say, okay, let's stop CPR and check the pulse. You don't want to just very bluntly say time of death is, but sometimes that is the type of closure that people need. And so if there's family present, I'll say I'm very sorry and just speak to them and maybe not say the official time of death. But I haven't quite figured out how to phrase that. It just feels very awkward and weird to say what you actually say when you're stopping a code. And then you kind of think things just very... They also become silent again in some ways.
And I remember this particular patient unfortunately didn't make it. And the wife just, when she heard that he had died, just started to scream. And you could hear her all over the emergency room. And obviously staff get pretty upset when patients have that kind of outward expressing of emotion. And you know, sometimes part of my job is to reassure staff that it's okay that they're screaming and crying. This is the time when you should be screaming and crying. doctors and nurses especially, you know, they're taught to go from one critical situation to another. So you have to have really strict boundaries. But when you can hear your previous patient's wife screaming from the next room, it's hard to kind of walk away from that. There's several doctors that will snap their gloves off and throw them on the floor and walk out. And I think that is their way of kind of literally like washing their hands of the situation. It's like, okay, we're done. I'm leaving these here and I'm moving on.
I think a lot of the images that I have reflecting back are of someone making space next to the bedside, even while chest compressions are going on or near the head, to allow the family member to go and to physically touch their family member and to either hold their hand or to stroke their forehead. Those are the images that I have from a lot of the codes. You do break away from the technical aspects of it and the actual medications and algorithms, and remember that there's actually a patient underneath all this chaos. And when the family comes in and goes to hold their hand, you remember, wow, that's not just an arm to get IV access, and that's their hand.
Especially in the hospital, the word code gets thrown around so often. And I think the meaning of what's going on in the room often gets lost because it's something that just happens in a hospital. It's a part of daily life. But when you bring it back, that's why when we refer to a code, I always refer to the person as being dead, because I feel like it brings people to the realization of how serious this was. And I think a lot of times that gets lost, but it's the most important part, I think, of the code, and people need to have that in the forefront of their mind when talking, thinking, or being in a code, that this is a person and that this person is dead.
Long after the code has ended and the patient has gone home or been laid to rest, the memory of the event itself lingers within the world of the hospital, retold and re-experienced by those involved.
Blood. Blood, seeing blood made me fearful. And also seeing when they're compressing that person, you know, you see the vulnerability of a human.
Father Chris is saying when they are compressing that person, you see the vulnerability of a human.
I said,
I can't believe it, because I was just talking with a patient. When I come back, I see a whole pack of doctors compressing him.
And I looked down, I remember seeing his eyes half open, and it just flashed across my mind, like, this guy, this is like somebody's dad, somebody's grandfather. You know, it's weird because you got, on the one hand, you're trying to maintain your professional composure, and on the other hand, you know, on one hand it's a machine, and on the other hand it's a person. I remember having this thought: the only intervention this guy really needs is a blanket.
These moments often work their way into dreams.
So yes, I have dreamt about a code. And in the dream, he was a particularly small, kind of frail-looking gentleman. I remember with every compression that I was doing, I felt like I was, like, you know, folding his body in half and doing more harm than good. And it was a terrible feeling that, you know, this is something that's necessary, but you feel like you're harming or breaking this person, and you're causing this hurt that you can see so vividly in front of you, and it's a horrible feeling.
One of the most important things of a code, I think, as a supervisor and as an educator, is to debrief with the staff. So we want to review even their emotions at that point, because that has a huge bearing on how they're reacting and how they're able to manage at that point in time. So we're all human beings, just like the person in the bed who has gone out on us. So we want to make sure that, you know, we're kind of identifying that all of those things are happening at the same time within all of us.
It's
like it could happen to me too. I always think whatever happens to someone else, it could happen to me too. Even me, I might be working and they could call Code Blue for me. I've heard them call Code Blue for staff before. What I do when I get home to either my husband or my child, I'll say, this life, you can't understand it.
A hospital is a big machine that has both organic and mechanical components to it.
This is Hader again, senior resident in internal medicine.
The organic component is the interaction between people, and the mechanical component is the act of giving medications, the tubing of like lab results. And I think if you look at a code, you see all those things happen at the same time. There's a lot of biology at play. There's a lot of medications that we're giving triggers certain chemical reactions in the body. But there's also this connection of eyes, words that are said. I feel that hospitals are more and more going towards a more mechanical side of medicine, which is there's more regulations, there's more paperwork. But I think codes emphasize the human aspect of being in medicine, in which no one speaks below their breath. If you think something, you probably are saying it out loud to someone else. You meet 50 people in 50 seconds. And sometimes magic happens and sometimes horrible outcomes happen, but that's why we're all here.
Nurses, doctors, housekeepers, chaplains, social workers. The hospital is nearly as diverse as the city itself. Yet a code is one of those moments when rank and title seem somewhat to lose importance, facing the shared limits of our human capacity. I expected to be disheartened by months of listening to stories of codes, often violent and sometimes futile, but at the same time I found a sad beauty in all of this, that in confronting death together, we sometimes begin to find one another.
There's something unsaid in codes that brings people together in a way that you can't capture on a sheet. You can't put a blip on a spreadsheet. And I think for a lot of people, it just reminds them why they started doing what they're doing in the first place.
You've been listening to Anatomy of a Code Blue, produced by Sam Slavin with Vicki Merrick for the public radio website Transom.org, based in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. To find out more about this program, including Sam's notes on making the piece, visit Transom.org. Funding for the show came from the National Endowment for the Arts and from the supporters of Transom, a website that offers the tools and skills to make your own stories for public radio. This story, for instance, was the first piece produced by Sam Slavin. The voices you heard in this program were physical therapist Sharon Casey, social worker Margot Cronin-Furman, physician Kareen Kilaru, housekeeper Marie Lesage, chaplain Christian Ohazalume, supervising RN Patty Parody, nurse Corey Porter, physician Adarsh Thacker, physician Patrick Tyler, and physician Heather Vereich. Thanks to the Neil Samuel Giso Foundation for Compassionate Medical Care and the Scholarship in Medicine Program at Harvard Medical School for their financial support to Sam. Special thanks to the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, its staff and its patients, without whom this piece would not have been possible. From Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Jay Allison.